Hi, this is Maria Olson. You may know me from Trophy Heads or Starry Eyes and maybe Paranormal Activity 3. And I want to welcome you to Anthony T's Horror Show because it's an awesome show.
Hi, my name is Jessica Cameron and you're listening to Anthony T's Horror Show.
Hey, fellow horror fans. This is Troy Escamilla, the director of Party Night and Mrs. Claus. And you are listening to Anthony T's Horror Show. Enjoy.
Welcome to another edition of Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm Anthony T. In this edition, I will have not one, but two interviews on the podcast. Next segment, I'll be talking to Jacob Perrette, director of the new horror anthology Spine Chiller, which was recently released by Scream Team Releasing. Then after that, I'll be talking to director Ronnie Patel about his latest film, Chop Chop, which is available through Gravitas Ventures. All this, plus I will talk about a film that has recently divided the Shudder fan base as Shudder previewed the 2021 slate of films by actually screening one of the films on Halloween night, which is a film that caught everybody off guard because, let's face it, it was screening after John Carpenter's Halloween on Halloween night. It's a film that really I was surprised they showed, considering it's nothing like Halloween. And at 10:30 at night, it was one of those films where you had to think. Seriously, it was one of those films that you had to think, because it's not a typical horror film. It's more of an art house type of horror film. Something that like A24 would put out. I'll talk about that film in What's Anthony T Watching. But first, I have a news topic that I want to talk about. Now, I could go one or two ways here. I could talk about something that is really newsworthy, or I can let Jason Blum hijack the podcast again and talk about a news item that dropped during Jason Blum's own virtual convention. That's right, Jason Blum had his own virtual con, meaning it was all about Blumhouse Pictures and Jason Blum. You know what? I'll talk about the other thing because this is concerning a master of horror. And don't get me wrong, Jason Blum is a master of horror. He's produced such great horror films. But this is one of the masters of horror. So I can't give Jason Blum airtime this episode. Sorry, Jason. I love to talk about you every episode. But when a master of horror makes news, I have to talk about it. And that master of horror is Clive Barker again, yes. In episode 51, I talked about him executive producing Nightbreed. Some major news dropped between episode 51 and this episode. Clive Barker will be one of the executive producers for the upcoming Hellraiser TV series. Now, this TV series I've been anticipating ever since hearing David Gordon Green and Michael Dougherty were going to be involved with the series. Don't get me wrong, those are great names to have around your series. But Clive Barker executive producing the Hellraiser TV series is a big deal. And I will tell you why it's a big deal. Because next year, Clive Barker can get the rights back to the Hellraiser franchise, which would have put any Hellraiser properties on hold, because there would be another major legal fight. The same type of fight with the Friday the 13th franchise. Kind of legal fight. So, when I heard Clive Barker was announced that he is joining the Hellraiser TV series, this made me super excited. Because it now guarantees that a Hellraiser TV series is going to happen. Hey, it might have still happened, but if you can get the legal part out of the way, it just makes it smooth sailing. And that's what happened when Clive Barker was announced as an executive producer of the upcoming Hellraiser TV series on HBO. It's going to move and not have any hurdles. Because the one thing I was worried about was the fact that the rights could revert back to Clive Barker in 2021. And there would be major problems regarding the Hellraiser franchise over the fight over who has the rights to that franchise. But now with Clive Barker on board executive producing the Hellraiser TV series, there's no worry. We're probably going to get a Hellraiser TV series. Finally, something positive on the Hellraiser front. This is major news, because this could bring Hellraiser back to relevancy. Because after Hellraiser 4 Bloodlines, that series went downhill into a series of direct-to-video releases. Now, that's not going to be a problem here, because this is going to be a TV series, and it's going to be on HBO. So, it's going to be very interesting to see how this TV series pans out. Because I'm very excited for the upcoming TV series. And it looks like there is no more major hurdles towards that. Which is a very good thing. Because if there was hurdles, like the fact that the rights could revert to Clive Barker and we end up in lawsuit territory, we could be without a Hellraiser film or TV series for years. Look at the Friday the 13th series. We haven't seen Jason in 3-4 years, pretty much? It's been a while since Jason was last on the big screen. So, I'm very excited for this Hellraiser TV series, if I wasn't already. Because with Clive Barker's name attached to it, it makes it probably the most anticipated horror TV series to come on the airwaves since The Walking Dead. For me, it is, quite frankly, because I'm a huge Hellraiser fan. And I'm very excited for this piece of news. Now you have Clive Barker, David Gordon Green, and Michael Dougherty all involved in the new Hellraiser TV series. This is probably going to be something to keep an eye on. Because I could see this being probably one of the best horror TV series to come out since The Walking Dead. And with that, that's the news. Besides Anthony T's horror show, you can also listen to these other fine podcasts on the Doc Discussions Network. Doc Discussions, hosted by Philip Perrone and Michael Darwin. You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast. Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast. Halloween Boutique, Psychotronic Reviews, and Searching for American Gods. You can find Doc Discussions on the web at www.docdiscussions.com. And Doc Discussions is also available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm here with a director who has not one, but two films released this year. He has the film Weird Fiction, which was released early in the year from Wild Eye Releasing. And his latest film, Spine Chiller, is being released by Scream Team Releasing. I am here with director Jacob Perrett. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
Good. What got you into filmmaking?
Well, I've been doing it for a while now. I mean, I'm not very old. I'm only 22 years old, but I got into it back. I don't know. I think I was like maybe around 10 years old. Basically, I was kind of at that age where I wasn't able to, you know, be at home by myself. So like if I ever had a day off of school, I'd have to go into work with like, you know, either my mom or my dad. And as you can imagine, that got pretty boring after a while. But it was also, you know, kind of around that time where platforms like YouTube were starting to get more popular. So what I would do is, you know, whenever I would get bored, you know, being at work with them, I would go on YouTube and I would check out everything, you know, that was being, you know, created at that time. And it was so new. Like prior to that, like I had no idea that people were able to create content without big, massive budgets and everything like that. So my filmmaking journey kind of started with YouTube and creating content on that platform. And then somewhere along the way, kind of like towards my, I think like my senior year of high school was when I kind of started taking directing and writing and filmmaking seriously. And so yeah, it kind of started around when I was 10 years old. And I should probably mention that it was also around that time when I saw A Nightmare on Elm Street for the first time, and that's kind of what got me into specifically the horror genre.
You have two films that were released this year. This first start with Weird Fiction, since I'll be mentioning that film during the course of this interview. Tell everyone about that film.
Yeah, so Weird Fiction is my directorial debut. And it is an anthology feature film made very much so in the vein of like 80s horror, like kind of like retro style films like that. And it's basically it's almost kind of like a creep show. Like we have a Tales from the Crypt. It has a kind of like a horror host that kind of introduces each segment. And within the film, we have four different segments. The first one, you know, we cover the slasher genre. We have aliens in it. We have, you know, weird, zombies and creatures under the bed. It's really just, kind of like a giant hodgepodge and like homage to, retro horror and the horror genre itself.
What made you want to make an anthology film your first feature film instead of a traditional film?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting with Weird Fiction, because when we first started it, we didn't necessarily know what it was yet. Basically, we started shooting the first short film, which was called The Incubus, back in the summer of 2017, I believe. And at the time, you know, we were just kind of making short films here and there, and there was no goal for it per se. You know, it was just kind of like for our YouTube audience and everything. And from there, I went on and, you know, Incubus was on YouTube and everything. And, I was going to college for film at the time. And one of my assignments, I ended up doing Night of the Sitter, for it, which, is another segment, in Weird Fiction. And that kind of went back to that retro vibe that, the Incubus had had. And, I really liked, doing that style and kind of making it campy and cheesy and, you know, stuff like that. And, it was kind of like after Night of the Sitter where I went to my main collaborator and, my best friend, his name's, Taylor Rhodes. And, I was like, you know, I really like doing shorts like this, you know, where they're retro and they're cheesy and we got creatures and everything. Why don't we make one more and, you know, just cap it off as like our retro trilogy? And at that point, Taylor was like, well, why don't we just, you know, make another one and finish it off as, you know, a full anthology feature film. And, you know, that's kind of, how it came about. And I think also it kind of, doing an anthology for your first feature film is kind of beneficial, because taking on a feature film, you know, like a full narrative, like start to finish, is a very, daunting task for like a beginner, you know, filmmaker. So doing an anthology almost kind of made it more palatable. Like, okay, we have, you know, not just one long start to finish. We have four different start to finishes, and, you know, we're just going to all kind of copy and paste them into, you know, in the end.
I noticed that some of the cast in Weird Fiction also appear in your latest film, Spine Chiller. What was it like finding the cast for Weird Fiction?
Yeah, finding the cast was honestly extremely difficult, you know, given the area that we're from. We're from a very small town in Pennsylvania, and really, like, the only artistic avenues that are really explored around this area are, like, theater, and I feel like a lot of actors and actresses who are involved in theater around here, you know, they're a little bit older, and when you're approached by a young director, when I did Weird Fiction, I was like 18, 19, something like that, maybe 20 actually. But you know, I was really young. And when you approach these older actors and actresses, you almost kind of, I think, lack credibility. So they're not necessarily as willing to, you know, jump on board on your project and, you know, kind of get behind you as the director and like the main driving force. So given all of that, I had to kind of search in other places. And what I kind of found was, you know, an actor like Taylor Rhodes, who is featured in every segment on Weird Fiction, he had no real acting experience prior to Weird Fiction. But that was okay, because I feel like there are just some people who are inherently, they understand, the art and the language of filmmaking and what they want to see out of an actor on film. And, they do that as well. And we actually, for Isabella Rodriguez, who is also featured quite a bit on Weird Fiction, she was kind of a unique case because she was from, Erie, Pennsylvania, which is about close to like an hour away from us. But for the most part, everyone else was just, kind of from our community. And, you know, we're all friends and movie lovers and, you know, stuff like that.
What gave you the idea to have Taylor Rhodes in each of the stories?
He's just, I like to think of it as like, Taylor is the Johnny Depp to my Tim Burton, I guess, if you want to say that. You know, we just really, we understand one another, and he understands, what I want from him as an actor. And, you know, we just have a really good working relationship on set. And, you know, we're friends, you know, behind the scenes. And, yeah, just a really good understanding of one another. And, yeah.
How long did it take to shoot each segment?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like for a majority of them, it was, honestly, we probably shot most of them in like a month, you know, just shooting on the weekends. Like, we'd shoot like pretty much, you know, because everyone's working or going to school during the week. So we'd shoot maybe Friday nights, Saturdays, Sundays. Probably took about a month. But the one, the one interesting thing is, I think I had mentioned before that the Night of the Sitter segment was made for a school project of mine. And, you know, given it's a school project, I had a deadline and, you know, all that stuff. So that was kind of interesting because we shot the whole entire segment within, I think, the time span of like 8 hours, which was awful and horrible. And I never want to do it again just because, like, it was so much, you know, for one day. And, but yeah, no, aside from, so yeah, Night of the Sitter was done in like 8 hours, where like, the rest of the segments were probably like a month, not including, you know, the time it took to write them.
Would I say that Night of the Sitter was the most difficult segment to film?
Honestly, each segment has its own unique, difficulties and challenges, but I would say that, yeah, you'd probably be right by assuming that Night of the Sitter was most difficult.
What were some of the pitfalls of filmmaking that you experienced while making Weird Fiction?
Yeah, so what's interesting, like, I've always kind of, whereas, you know, maybe other directors, filmmakers, like to focus on specifically like one area of filmmaking. So like, you know, say, oh, I'm a filmmaker, but I'm specifically interested in, you know, being a director. So that's what they pursue, being a director. Whereas I've kind of grown up and taught myself to be like a jack of all trades, I guess. So not only do I write the segments, but, you know, I directed them. I did cinematography for them. I edited them and, you know, I acted as the collector. So I think probably like, the biggest pitfall or like the biggest, challenge would be just personally finding the, how to juggle like all these various roles. And in the meantime, maintaining the balance between everything, you know, going on set and, you know, just making sure that the film is getting done and it's, the best it can be and enjoying it too, you know, because when you have all these roles, it's easy to, you know, get stressed out and, you know, not maybe enjoy the project as much as you would if you weren't doing all these roles. But, yeah, I'd say that was probably the biggest challenge or pitfall.
Was that corrected in your latest film?
Spine Chiller?
Yes.
No, I unfortunately did not learn my lesson. In fact, I'm sure we'll talk about it later on in the interview, but I added to my juggling by personally taking on trying to score the film as well. So not only am I doing all that stuff, but I'd also trying to teach myself how to do music and, you know, doing the score for it as well.
Last question before we get to Spine Chiller. What special features can be found on the Weird Fiction DVD?
On the Weird Fiction DVD, there is a director's commentary with both Taylor and I, as well as a behind-the-scenes documentary that was crafted together by Dr. Udru, who is a YouTuber. He does like a lot of horror history type videos. So yeah, make sure you go check him out if you like horror and, you know, horror history. And finally, there are trailers. I think we had maybe two trailers for the film, but you can find those on the special features as well.
Let's move to Spine Chiller, which was recently released from Scream Team Releasing. Tell everyone about the film.
Yeah, so Spine Chiller, a lot like Weird Fiction, is another anthology, but it's also another homage to 80s horror, and I'd probably say 70s and 80s horror for this one. And it's basically about this town where there's this Halloween dance that comes to this town each year. And every year surrounded by this dance is this string of disappearances. And the film kind of follows these four individuals who have been invited to the dance this year. And we follow their adventures and their stories as they kind of uncover what is really going on at this mysterious, you know, Halloween Spine Chiller dance. And it's also kind of different from Weird Fiction in the sense that, yes, it is an anthology, but the segments aren't as defined as Weird Fiction. The segments in Spine Chiller are kind of more so in the vein of, like, you know, maybe a movie like Trick or Treat, where it has different stories, but they all kind of cross paths, and they're kind of like, just kind of like an anthology in that sense.
Since you mentioned it, what made you want to have all the segments connect to one story instead of having a traditional anthology film?
Well, it was kind of, it's almost like a stepping stone towards making like a straight up like feature, like, you know, narrative non-anthology film. Like I said before, like when you do an anthology, it makes it a lot easier. Whereas this one, with Spine Chiller, it is an anthology, but when you watch it, you don't necessarily feel as though it is an anthology in the sense of, oh, you watch Weird Fiction, you're like, oh, that's where the segment, that's what it's called, and that's where it ends. With Spine Chiller, yeah, I wanted it to still be an anthology so it was easy to make, but also kind of have a step towards the feeling of watching a straight, cohesive narrative film.
Now, besides that difference from Spine Chiller and Weird Fiction, another difference I noticed of the two films is that in Weird Fiction you had title cards at the beginning of each story, and in this film you don't. What made you decide not to use title cards to start off each segment in Spine Chiller?
I think it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the cohesiveness of the film. I wanted the viewer to be able to watch it as if they are watching like a straight up non-anthology film. It would almost, I feel like, interrupt the flow if I were to include title cards in Spine Chiller, because the audience wouldn't be so, they would be more focused on, okay, that's where this segment starts and that's when, you know, the segment ends, as where I wanted them to kind of watch it as, okay, we're watching this character and this is the story, and okay, it's moving into something else. Oh, wait, I saw, you know, that character from a couple segments ago. So I didn't want it to feel like a start-stop flow. I wanted it to feel like a more gradual, like, beginning and end.
Both of those films have Halloween as a central theme. What made you want to have Halloween as part of your first two films?
Oh, I've always loved Halloween. It's always been my favorite holiday. And coincidentally enough, my birthday's actually on Halloween, which, you know, people always assume when they find that out, they're like, oh, well, you like Halloween because it's your birthday. It's like, no, I genuinely, I don't know. I've just always been, infatuated with that time of year and, you know, movies and music that kind of make me, feel like it's that time of year, no matter what time of year I might be, you know, watching or listening to them. Like John Carpenter's Halloween, for example, is, or even Trick or Treat, like we were talking about earlier. Those are two films that I could watch in the summertime, and I could feel as though, you know, we're in fall or like in the midst of fall. And, I think there's also, there's a big, nostalgia factor for not only myself, but people who love Halloween as well. Just trying to tap into that that nostalgia, I guess.
When I was watching this film, I noticed that you had trick-or-treating going on October 30th. What made you decide to have trick-or-treating going on that date? Was that a goof or was that purpose?
That was on purpose. And what's interesting whenever I talk about this, people are always like weirded out. But, the town that I grew up in, we've never had trick or treat on Halloween. It was always on like, you know, some odd date, like, you know, October 28th or something like that. Typically it would be on like a Thursday night and we would have the following Friday off of school. I think because they assume that, you know, all the kids are going to be out, they're going to be eating candy and, you know, going crazy and all that stuff. So that's, that was done on purpose. And, you know, to me, like when I was crafting the film writing, I was like, oh, it's not weird at all that, you know, Halloween or excuse me, Trick or Treat is not on October 31st, but that's interesting that to other people that that's such a strange thing. Whereas, you know, that's what I grew up with.
I noticed on IMDb that you made this film for $1,000. The film really has a very good professional look. What was it like trying to make sure that this film had a retro grindhouse look?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. I feel like there are a lot of modern filmmakers out there, aside from myself, who are shooting these films on modern equipment and then trying to downgrade them in post-production in order to kind of, put in that grain and that, you know, that grime and to try and replicate old film. But one of the difficult things is, you know, there are some filmmakers out there who are shooting films like this on like a Blackmagic, you know, Ursa Mini 4K, you know. But the thing is like you can't, it's a lot harder to give that grit and grime vibe when you're shooting it in 4K. I shot Weird Fiction and Spine Chiller on two separate cameras. With Weird Fiction, I shot it on a Canon Rebel T3i with an array of different cinema lenses. And the Canon Rebel T3i, while it's not, you know, it's not the worst quality, but it's also not the best. And I think by it not being the best, it almost worked in favor of the film because it doesn't feel like you're watching a, it's like, you know, like a modern, like, 4K, you know, horror movie, you know, it has like an essence of, okay, well, this might have been shot on film or, you know, on an old cinema camera. With Spine Chiller, I had upgraded my cameras in between the two projects, and I shot Spine Chiller with a Canon C100, with, you know, another, set of like cinema lenses. And I feel like, the C100 is just like on the brink of being too, crystal clean for, you know, like this 80s style, filmmaking, but it doesn't go quite over. But I always go in, you know, once the project is done, and I add in, you know, some grain and stuff like that.
What were some of the challenges and differences you faced while filming Spine Chiller, considering that this film had a micro budget like Weird Fiction?
Yeah, it was actually the budgets for both of them are minuscule. Like, I feel like in Hollywood now you can say like a movie's made for like $1 million and they're like, oh, that's a micro budget. It's like, what? That's insane. But, Weird Fiction, yeah, was made for like, around $300. And, Spine Chiller, yeah, was made for around $1,000. We had a funding campaign, in Indiegogo for Spine Chiller, and I don't think we met our goal. We rarely ever do, meet our goal, but I think the difference is, and also I guess one of the challenges is, you know, even though we're not making as much, money budget wise as we hope, we are also, you know, the type of group that's not going to let it make or break us. It's like, yes, we would like to make this film for, you know, whatever it may be, $5,000, $10,000. But if we don't get there, we're still going to find a way to do it. You know, it might not be how we would like to or how we envisioned it initially, but, you know, we will always find a way. And, you know, just that state of mind brings its, you know, enough challenges in and of itself, because it's like, okay, we only have $1,000 and we have an hour and however many minutes of film to shoot. And, you know, we got to make sure that it looks good and that, it, you know. So, well, I think the budget is definitely a challenge. I wouldn't say that it is a hindrance on us, per se.
What was the most difficult scene to film in Spine Chiller?
With Spine Chiller, I would definitely probably have to say the final battle between Ryan and the Pumpkin Man, and in the final segment, specifically when they're like in the bathroom and Tabby's there and everything. That was difficult because we were shooting at a movie theater after hours, and so we weren't allowed to, you know, start until the last movie was out. And I think the last movie was out probably sometime after midnight, so we didn't even get in there and, you know, start to get the bathroom set up until like, you know, close to 1 a.m. So, you know, we're dealing with that, and, you know, we have to be out by like 7 a.m. And so we're shooting all this stuff. And then, you know, we have, of course, that day, we had gallons and gallons of blood that we were, you know, shooting and spraying everywhere. So on top of all that, you know, we finished, we were like cleaning the bathroom for like 2 hours, and we just barely got out of there in time before the owner of the theater probably would have gotten there and saw the state of the place and been like, oh boy. I don't think he knew what exactly we were shooting, but yeah, that was probably the most difficult, just because of like the time crunch and everything.
Speaking of Ryan, what was it like trying to cast the lead role for Ryan?
Yeah, so Ryan is played by Derek Hyde, and Derek is a mutual friend of Taylor and I, and we had kind of established a working relationship in a couple short films leading up to Spine Chiller. We did two of them. We did one called The Spider Has a Face, and we did another called Such Things Happen, which is based off of one of the short stories in Alvin Schwartz's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. I believe it's the third one. So we kind of, Derek and I had kind of established a working relationship between those films and a friendship behind the scenes. By the way, if you're interested, you can go see The Spider Has a Face and Such Things Happen on my YouTube channel. But yeah, it was Taylor has so much weight on his shoulders in these films. Like we mentioned before, in Weird Fiction, he played a main role in pretty much every segment. So, you know, going into Spine Chiller, I wanted Taylor to have a prominent part because he is, you know, I think he's so good at what he does. But I also kind of wanted to take the, you know, some of the weight off of his shoulders and kind of introduce a new actor into our Fame Cinema group, which happened to be Derek.
What made you want to bring some of the cast from Weird Fiction back for Spine Chiller?
I think it comes down to, I mean, not only are they my friends and, you know, we have such a good working relationship together. So, of course, you know, I'd want to bring them back. But I think it also goes back to those, like, the limitations of our area. Like, I have no choice but to cast the group that I do just because, you know, otherwise it's like, oh, we're not going to have, you know, any actors at all because no one in this area is interested in absolutely anything, you know, we're doing once, you know, nothing to do with any of our films or, you know, projects that we're working on.
Was this an easier time making this film compared to Weird Fiction?
Yeah, I think so. Mainly because I kind of took what I learned from Weird Fiction and applied it to Spine Chiller. I guess you could say I got better at juggling all my roles, you know, whether it be, you know, directing, cinematography. And also, I would say it was easier, you know, just from all of my lessons from my Weird Fiction, you know, which was the directorial debut, you know, you're kind of, it's kind of new at it and everything, so.
I also noticed you act in the film as well. What made you decide to get in front of the camera?
It's actually, it's kind of funny. Going back to Weird Fiction, I play the Collector, which is kind of the mascot, I guess you could say, of the film. Kind of like this Crypt Keeper-esque character. And I can't tell you why I wanted to do it. I just thought that it would be a lot of fun, you know, playing a creature and being in the makeup. And I think also by putting myself in positions where I have to act and perform in front of the camera, I also am doing a service to the actors that I employ because it kind of puts me in their shoes and I am able to firsthand experience, you know, the things that they go through and the challenges they face and everything like that.
Now, in Spine Chiller, I noticed you play a show director. Is that how you direct in real life, or is it, like, just different?
I think it's totally different. I think for that scene, I was sitting in, like a director's chair next to a camera and, you know, barking out orders or something like that. Whereas in real life, it's a lot more hectic because I am, you know, I would probably be behind the camera, you know, switching out lenses, you know, figuring out, you know, what the next shot is going to be on top of, you know, walking the actors, you know, through choreography and, you know, what they're going to be doing for that, the, you know, the next scene.
You also did the score for this film as well. What made you want to do the score for Spine Chiller?
I had started to get into music. I've always been interested in music production and, you know, everything involved with that. So I bought a MIDI keyboard and just kind of started messing around in GarageBand, and which I still do. I make like a lot of indie music, I guess you could say. But I've always, as far as like film goes, especially in the 80s, I've always been, you know, infatuated with John Carpenter and, you know, his stuff as well as, you know, some other like Italian films like Suspiria. Like I think Goblin, you know, scored that. Just like these really weird and bizarre, but like really cool, interesting music pieces. I've always been interested in that. And luckily now with the technology that we have there, it's a lot easier to do things like that. You know, as long as you have a keyboard and GarageBand, you know, you can make an endless array of different compositions.
That was another thing that I really liked about that film, because it really felt like it had this retro 80s vibe and Italian horror film vibe all in the same film. What were some of the films that inspired the score?
Definitely anything that John Carpenter has done. I'm also a fan. I wouldn't say I'm a big fan of Lucio Fulci just because I haven't seen all of his movies, but mainly his film House by the Cemetery. That score is so great. Definitely check it out, you know, if you haven't already. But I would say probably John Carpenter and any score from a Lucio Fulci film. And I can't think of the name of who scores his stuff.
I know he had a different couple of composers, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Spine Chillers being released by Scream Team Releasing, who's put out some really good films in the past, including Close Calls, The Bond. What made you decide to go with Scream Team Releasing for Spine Chiller instead of Wild Eye Releasing, who distributed Weird Fiction?
I've kind of been attempting to find a new distributor with each film that comes out, just because I want to, I guess, broaden my reach as much as I can. I always assume that, you know, there are fans of Wild Eye Releasing who, you know, will watch anything that they put out, as well as there are fans, you know, with Scream Team that, you know, these unique fans that will watch anything. So I guess I'm just trying to see, or I guess get people, as many different groups of these, you know, people and these horror fans, just trying to reach them, I guess, by using the different avenues of distributors. I got three films distributed now. Yeah, Weird Fiction, like you mentioned, is Wild Eye. Spine Chiller is Scream Team. And ITN is actually my most recent film, which is called Creature in the Dark. ITN has picked that up for distribution, which I think it should be potentially releasing next year. I don't know, maybe something like that. But with Scream Team, it's a really awesome story for me personally, at least, because I had always known of their presence, I guess. I remember, you know, seeing stuff for The Barn and Rocky Gray's 1031 movies. Actually, I remember we had a family video in town. It's closed now, unfortunately. But I went there and I found 1031 on the shelf and I was like, oh, holy shit, that's, you know, that's awesome. And, you know, I rented that and just fell in love with that style of filmmaking. And it literally, you know, it's a kind of it sounds cheesy, but it's kind of like a dream come true, because, you know, I'd always almost idolized these films like The Barn and 1031 and Close Calls. And to finally, you know, work with these people, you know, it was just a really cool experience.
What special features can be found on the Spine Chiller Blu-ray?
On the Spine Chiller Blu-ray, there is a commentary, again, done by Taylor and I. There is a making of featurette. There's a trailer, and there is a local ad teaser, which was kind of made to advertise the film when it was showing at local theaters here in Pennsylvania. Yeah, those are the special features on Spine Chiller.
Is the film going to be available on VOD in the future, like Weird Fiction, which is currently available on Tubi and Amazon Prime?
Yes, I believe that is the plan. I actually recently talked to Justin, who works over at Scream Team, and we are in the talks of getting Spine Chiller to different, you know, online platforms. And we're also potentially, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say much detail, also potentially talking about foreign distribution as well. The time frame for those, I'm not necessarily sure just yet, but it is looking like it's going to be available online specifically in the future.
Do you have any upcoming films on the horizon? I know you mentioned one that's going to be released by ITN Distribution. Do you have any others that are in production or ready to be released?
Creature in the Dark, yeah, it will be hopefully sometime next year. If you're curious about that project, you can head over to my YouTube channel as well, and there is a trailer on there and an exclusive clip. That film is kind of my full-on departure from the anthology setup, and it's actually, you know, the film that I'm most proud of, so I'm excited for that to be out there. And I'm currently in the process of filming one right now, which is called The Dead Sleep Soundly. And we just wrapped on our Indiegogo funding campaign for it a couple weeks ago. So as of right now, we are just trying to finish that up. And I think we're going to be wrapped in December. So hopefully, you know, everything goes well with that. It's been difficult because of COVID and everything going on. But yeah, a lot of exciting things. I'm trying to do maybe one feature a year. I did two this year, but yeah, trying to do at least one feature a year.
Where can they find you in Fame Cinema Group on social media?
I am on Instagram and Twitter. My Instagram handle is @JacobSpeaks, and my Twitter handle is @SpeaksJacob, because Jacob Speaks was already taken. And also, if you're interested in following specifically our films on social media, we have a Facebook page for Weird Fiction, which I believe is just @WeirdFictionMovie, or you can just type in Weird Fiction and you'd probably be able to find it. And Spine Chiller is on Instagram @SpineChillerMovie.
And of course, your YouTube channel as well.
Yes, my YouTube channel as well. You can find it by typing in my name, Jacob Perrette, or you can find it by typing in Jacob Speaks.
Now, what can they find on your YouTube channel besides the short films you mentioned?
I do a lot of stuff on my YouTube channel, not necessarily like film related all the time. Like I said, I dabble in music a lot, so sometimes I'll post my music on there, or, you know, if I do like a song cover, anything like that, and anything Indiegogo wise, whether that be like a funding pitch video, that will always go on that channel as well. And actually, I forgot to mention, if you're a horror fan, I actually have a YouTube channel that is separate from Jacob Speaks. It's called Something Sinister, and it revolves around exclusively horror-related content, whether that be, you know, the scariest video games ever made, or, you know, top 10 creatures caught on camera, kind of stuff like that. And I also, you know, did stuff like top 10, you know, goriest films ever made. So if you're into stuff like that, you can check out my Something Sinister videos as well.
Jacob, I want to thank you for coming on to this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Have a good day and stay safe.
Yep, you as well.
Every day there's a family struggling with hospital bills to care for their sick child who is fighting an illness. There's a woman who is fighting breast cancer and is having trouble making ends meet while paying for their treatment. And there are burn victims that are going through treatments to heal their deep wounds. There is a charity in the horror community that helps these people. Scares That Care is an organization that helps families deal with the bills for their child. They help women get the treatment they need to fight breast cancer, and they help people who are dealing with severe burns get the help they need to heal. Scares That Care is a 100% volunteer organization and 501c3 nonprofit charity that is dedicated to helping these people in fighting real monsters. To find out more information or to donate to Scares That Care, you can go to www.scaresthatcare.org. Every donation helps Scares That Care fight real monsters.
Hey guys, this is Steven Christina. I'm the founder, owner, creator, and host of Super Retro Throwback Reviews. Are you looking for the best movie reviews, music reviews, video game reviews, and Comic-Con coverage all around? Well then look no further. Definitely check out Super Retro Throwback Reviews on YouTube and our new audio podcast, the new and improved Super Retro Throwback Reviews Audio Files version 2.0 on the following media distributors: Podbean, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify.
Class is over, John! Time for something new and improved!
Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. I am here with writer, director, editor, Ronnie Patel, as we are here to talk about his latest film, Chop Chop. which is currently available on DVD and VOD. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
Wonderful.
What made you want to get into filmmaking?
I grew up a cinephile. I would watch anything and everything. I was born and raised in India. That's where I'm from originally. But, you know, growing up, I was a total cinephile. I would watch anything, everything. And although, you know, kind of living in that part of the country back then, it was sort of lacking technology-wise. So I didn't really have, a typical filmmaker's childhood. I wasn't much into making home videos for the most part for the lack of resources and stuff like that growing up there. But I was always into, my interests always lied in the entertainment. We had theaters and all that. I lived in a pretty developed city, so I would constantly watch movies all the time on DVDs. We had VCDs back then, so on VCDs, cassettes. And then also in live entertainment, in the sense plays, dance choreography, a lot of that. And that interest and curiosity ultimately kind of led me to pursue filmmaking. I ended up going to film school here in the States. And that's pretty much how I got into it. It was just so much interest and curiosity for the craft. I wanted to try it out myself, get my hands on it physically to see how it works, everything behind the camera, putting it together, editing it. And that's sort of sums it up.
Chop Chop is your first feature film. Tell everyone about that film.
Okay, so it's hard to describe Chop Chop in one, a one-liner or sort of give a synopsis without spoiling things. So, I mean, as I see it, Chop Chop, as how we had envisioned it to begin with, it was supposed to be, it still is in my mind, a satire on the whole slasher meets crime thriller. And it centers on all the chaos that happens over one night after a head-chopping serial killer attacks this mysterious young couple who apparently has a dark past and has a secret of their own.
This is your first feature film, and you previously did three short films before this film. What made you want to transition from shorts to feature films, considering that you started making shorts back in 2012?
Right. Well, honestly, I've done a lot more shorts. They're just not on IMDb, because a lot of them were in film school. Dark Room, which I shot in 2012, that turned out pretty good. So I sent it to film festivals and stuff. And, you know, I got pretty good response, and there was something there that, I don't know, I gotta try this one more time. And that led to the next short film, and that got pretty good response. And that led to another short film, and then ultimately I was like, why don't I just make a feature? You know, it's pretty much just putting a bunch of short films together, if you want to look at it a certain way. It's just so the listeners know it's not. it's a whole different beast. But that is sort of what my thinking was. And also, I didn't want to make another short film, because short films essentially are, you know, it's a stepping stone to sort of. And the films, the shorts that I was making was, there was so much narrative work there. It was hard to use that as a calling card, because these days, in this day and age, especially in the last few years, what I've noticed is short films that sort of go viral or have gone into Sundance or one of those, those are the films that are considered a calling card to have the next feature lined up for you. And that just wasn't the case with my work. I had anticipated it would be, but it just wasn't. And so I sort of figured, why not make a feature film? Why not put all this energy and resources into making a single 81-minute, just think of it as I'm making a single 81-minute short compilation of short films, sort of. And, that was sort of the transition and thinking behind that.
How did you and co-writer Andrew Erickson come up with the film story?
So, this goes back to when we met at a bar on Melrose, actually. We were having drinks, and we were meeting primarily because we wanted to find a way to collaborate on something. And on my way to the meeting, I had this idea of a story, of a date night going haywire, interrupted. And then we kind of took it from there, and we were discussing, one thing led to another, and we were like, you know what, we obviously don't have a budget, that we were trying to do this with whatever resources we have available. And with that, I think, and if I'm going to be directing it, I knew for a fact I couldn't make anything too serious with it. I had to make something that is self-aware, sort of ironic. And then we got into talking about the, you know, how they're doing, like, some of the newer tropes and spins that you see in genre films where they turn the tables on the bad guys. And that makes for a pretty good, lighter version of what the genre film is supposed to be. And we kind of took that as an influence and we kind of went from there and we ran with it. And along the way, when we were writing it, my own taste of movies, of love for crime thrillers, you know, kind of spilled into the mix, and that's how it all developed.
What was the writing process like working with a co-writer compared to writing films by yourself like you did with your shorts?
It was so much better. I mean, with shorts, you don't really, I mean, with my shorts, I didn't really write much. It was more of sort of a blueprint. We kind of took it from there. There was a lot of improvising and a lot of things changed on set with shorts. And I like to keep it that way. I like to give the actors the room to do their thing. That's what my background is. Growing up, when I was involved in, like, you know, plays or live entertainment, I would, that kind of transpired. With feature film, there needed to be a script because we had to attract good talent, especially with the form of budget that we were working with. We weren't going to have an A-lister or even like a TV actor, but we still needed great actors. And LA is, oh my God, it has such a great talent pool. So I wanted to attract the best that were coming up. And for that, we needed a script. And for that, we needed like a proper structure and, you know, good dialogues and everything. Like, it had to be well structured overall. I couldn't just write like a 20-page treatment and send it around. So it was definitely very helpful there to have another co-writer who understands the logistics and the ins and outs of a properly structured and a well-written screenplay. So it was definitely very helpful in that sense. And we barely disagreed on anything, to be honest. We were kind of on the same page from the get-go. What tone we wanted. We knew the sort of dark humor we were going to use, and kind of keeping that at the front and center of everything we do. We knew we wanted to make something that is very ironic and self-aware of itself. So all that really, really came through well for me, at least.
What made you and Andrew also want to focus on the crime drama aspects, along with the horror that goes on in the film?
Yeah, and like I said, it was more of, we were kind of going with the flow. We were more like, okay, we have this idea of a serial killer interrupting somebody's lovely date night. But where do we go from here? And then once that first major beat happens in the film, I don't know, it just made sense to go the crime way. A lot of these decisions were definitely creative decisions, but I like to call them creative solutions, because we also had to be very aware of what we could pull off with the sort of scale of this budget. I mean, the scale of this project was. So it was one of those things, and the crime thing, I don't know, it just clicked. It made sense in a movie like this.
One of the things that I couldn't help myself and not think to myself is that this felt like a Tarantino film at times. What were some of the influences that were behind the screenplay?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they're pretty, you know, they're pretty, some pretty obvious homage to, you know, Tarantino. Obviously, he's one of my favorite filmmakers, for sure. As far as influences go, so Tarantino was definitely one of the influences, but I think what inspired us more was, like, I consider Tarantino a brand, a genre in itself. Like, to me, I would, if you ask me what is one of my favorite genres, it'd be a Tarantino genre, because I think, to me, his style is more of, like, you know, he does whatever the hell he wants to do. He, like, with the Kill Bill series, right, or with Once Upon a Time, he literally had a Bruce Lee fight scene in the middle of this, apparently, that was supposedly a horror, sort of a horror. Manson, you know, the Manson kind of want to spoil things there. But it was the idea of doing whatever the heck we want to do that kind of turned into this thing where it looks and don't get me wrong, once we got to that point, I definitely wanted to kind of do some homage work to Tarantino because I love him so much. You know, I idolize him. But what he does with his films is he doesn't limit it to a certain genre. He doesn't focus on one specific genre. He focuses on one specific tone, and then he includes whatever he wants to. And we kind of did that, and that is sort of born, like, that is a quality that I grew up with, because I come from India, and a lot of Bollywood films are sort of like that. Now, they're not the greatest films, obviously. Some of them are pretty poorly made, but it is just so deeply woven into the fabric of me culturally that it just that sort of thing comes naturally to me, to have action, a little bit of romance, to kind of throw in comedy. So it was a combination of everything. And of course, you know, Tarantino is God to me. So it was a combination of everything.
Was that also the reason why you also added title cards to some of the scenes during the course of the film?
That was not intended, actually, when we were writing the screenplay. It's just I saw the first cut and I felt it again. This goes back to being a creative solution, because when you film something of such small scale, it's bound to have a lot of flaws. The first cut, I remember watching it, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I spent this many years, or it wasn't years, but like an entire year doing this, and look how it, I wanted to kind of throw up. And that's how it is, you know, first cut, because when you're editing it, you're so connected with it. And I was editing the proxy workflow so that the footage even looked like crap. So it added to the grossness that I was feeling for what I was watching on the screen. But yeah, title cards was more of a creative solution because I wanted the film to be a little more streamlined. It was, to me, the first cut wasn't making, it was all over the place. And I was like, what is one way that I can kind of make it a little more focused? And then I thought of the title cards. And again, that comes from long before Tarantino started doing it. Like, it goes back to like some of the 60s and the 50s films that I have watched numerous times. And I, for the love of God, I can't think of that film, name of that film, one film. We actually watched it in film, so I loved it, so I watched it over and over again. It's an American film. I can't think of the name right now. But yeah, so it was definitely something that I wanted to use as a creative solution to kind of streamline the movie a little more.
What was the audition process like, finding your lead characters?
It took the longest to cast this film. It wasn't the toughest part. It was actually a lot of fun for me because, to me, I saw the film actually coming to life in my head. I could actually see the film once I started the casting process and I started casting these people. I went the hard route. You know, as soon as we had finished the first draft of the screenplay, I knew I had to start looking for the right actors. I was very, very, you know, very, very keen on doing that. So I had already started my research. I was going to a lot of these acting schools, drama schools. I went on Backstage, and I pretty much stalked my lead actors. I cold emailed them, giving them a little bit of the pitch and asking them to meet. And then we met up. And then we were like, okay, now I know who I want Chuck and Liv to be, but the most important part of this film is going to have to be their chemistry. So we kind of did a little bit of rehearsal, and that was their audition for me. And it worked out perfectly.
How long did the audition process take?
Audition process or the whole casting, like how I started? Because I was looking at the reels and stuff for like that primary audition.
Casting. We'll say casting.
Casting. Let's see. I started in definitely more than, for the entire film's casting, it would have to be almost like 5 months or so, because it was going through hundreds and sometimes thousands of profiles to find that right actor. Definitely more than a few months.
What was the hardest role to cast?
I think the hardest role to cast was the main villain, Teddy. And I'll tell you why. Because we had actually cast someone else for that role, and that person stopped answering their phone just the night before the shoot. So we had to cast all over again. It was a mess. It's one of those things that happens with a low-budget indie. But I would say with all the heartache and headache, and although one of the happiest accidents that we have had, I mean, we got to work with David Harper, who just turned out to be amazing. That was probably the hardest.
What was it like trying to get funding for this film, considering that this film doesn't have much of a commercial appeal?
I mean, we didn't even try to get funding for it. We knew this was, so this was, we were very, very, like, when me and Andrew started writing, we were like, okay, we are going to find a way to film this. Let's forget about the budget. We're going to utilize everything at our disposal. Let's just do what we want to do, because if we're going to pursue filmmaking as a career, there will be times in the future when we're working on a budget with a real project, they won't accept a project like this. So in this one, we have complete freedom, complete creative control. So let's begin writing and let's take it from there. Let's not worry about any returns on this film or whether this film will get distribution or whatever. Let's have fun with this. This is our calling card. It's an exercise. If nothing works out, think of it as a master's study in film. And that's how we rolled with it. So getting funding wasn't really an issue for us because we weren't even looking to get funding. We were just kind of, I'm self-financing, borrowing from friends, family. It was literally just, I don't know if there were any other DIY films this year, but this is definitely one of the, example of a complete DIY film.
When was this film shot?
This was shot over the period of 2018 and 2019. We broke it up between October to January. That was 15 days of shoot, roughly 15.
The film looked like it was shot in both the city and rural areas. What was it like finding the locations?
Finding the locations was very, very tough. We have a pretty, pretty cool community over here in Riverside, which is an hour and a half from LA. And they're pretty good with their film permits, and they're very indie friendly. So all the rural stuff that you see happened over there. We kind of rented out this ranch over there. And we got Airbnb for our cast and crew, and we stayed there for 4 days, and we shot that. The whole rural stuff that you see towards the end of the film was shot there. A lot of parking lot stuff exterior was shot in Riverside as well. And then some of the apartment stuff that you see was, it was sort of my apartment. So, it was difficult to get these locations because we were working on a budget, so it was very, very tough, actually. To get some of these houses and some of these parking lots and stuff like that.
What was the most difficult scene to shoot?
Oh, man, it was a while ago. So, I don't know, let me see. I know everything that happened over at the ranch was the easiest and the smoothest. I would say, it was a scene that is not included in the movie, actually. It was supposed to be the scene that happened... That was supposed to be the opening of the film where Teddy it's a kill scene that Teddy he's stalking this group of people and that there's a reason why it never made it into the film. It's because it was the toughest to shoot, and everything that could go wrong went wrong that day, from light not being right to the makeup just not working out on camera and a lot of stunts not panning out. And I think we made that day, meaning we were able to complete all the shots and takes, but it was so forced. So it would have to be that scene that never made it.
What was your favorite moment on set?
When it was over, the last day, the last day at the ranch. And not just because it was over. It was obviously. Yes, because it was over. It was such an achievement. And just that last day, kind of hugging everybody. And it had started raining, and it rarely ever rains in California, as you know. And it was just everything was so perfect that last day. All the shots, everything we shot that day was perfectly filmed without any errors or without any problems. So I would say the last day of the shoot.
What were some of the differences that you experienced directing a feature film compared to directing a short film?
The number of days was a big one because with shorts, the most I have gone is 3 days back to back chronologically. With this, it was sometimes it would be 5 days, and it was just because there was no break, and you barely get any sleep. That was the biggest difference in a challenging way. Other than that, I mean, there's definitely a lot at stake, but to me, for me, in order to have completed the filming process, I had to think of it as something very similar to what I have done before to kind of keep myself going. So I don't know, but definitely the number of days back to back was different. I shot most of these shorts I shot was on the East Coast, in Pennsylvania, near the Philadelphia area. So that was a lot less professional than how much professional I have to be here. But I think that was more of a California thing with all the permits and all the paperwork and stuff like that. I don't know even if I had done a short film here, it would have been pretty similar. But the number of days and just the overall pressure, once the filming process was over, the editing process began, and the whole seeking sales and distribution, all that was very different, obviously.
Besides writing, producing, editing, and directing, you're also the production designer.
Yes.
What does a production designer do, since we're going to talk about it a bit?
So production designer basically... So everything you see on the frame, like in a movie, if there's a shot, and then everything you see in the frame, the production designer is sort of responsible for, not the lighting part, because that's DP, and not the shot composition either. But say a table or a specific wallpaper or a carpet or a lamp that's supposed to be here, kind of just creating the set, sort of. Now don't quote me on this, because I know in bigger productions they have set decorator and art director, and then so there's a lot of, but on this particular film, it was when I credited myself and my wife production designer, it was pretty much that we created the set pretty much in a way.
What made you want to tackle that as well as everything else that you've done on the film?
I mean, I didn't have a choice. It was not saying it as a knock to anybody. It's just, I had no choice. It was just me kind of doing everything. And I had to either do it or let that aspect kind of go, because I didn't have the money to hire anybody for production design work. So I could very well, which a lot of micro budget films do, is they don't worry about it. They kind of have their AD in them, kind of, you know, work on a few things here and there, make sure everything, all the brands are taped up so you don't get in trouble, and just leave the location or the set the way it is, how they get it. With me, I wanted to go that extra mile. I wanted it to be, it's just a work ethic thing. And ultimately what ended up happening was I got super involved in how I wanted it to look. And that's how it kind of started.
What was it like trying to get those visual components to make your vision work?
It was, when we were filming it, I was constantly finding something wrong with one thing or another. Overall, I think now that I look back and how we were working and what we had at hand and the resources we had at hand, I'm pretty satisfied. I would have to say I'm pretty satisfied at what we could pull off. And, kudos to both our DPs. I mean, I know I put them through hell. When you ask a DP to work with what we had and what they pulled off here, I mean, they deserve all the credit.
On top of all that, you're also the editor of this film. What was the editing process like cutting this film to respectable running time?
Editing was, it was difficult. It was very difficult. Like I said, I mentioned before, the first rough cut was just, I did not like it at all. And then you kind of deal with those emotions of, was this a mistake? Should I even keep going? I mean, what's the point? And still kind of pushing yourself to kind of, you know, get it done. You started this, finish this. And then that kind of self-motivation talk leads you to think creatively, at least in my opinion. And I learned a thing or two about editing, and that is I may not edit another movie again, because I don't think I'm great at it. I think the editing is sort of flawed in the film. Technically speaking, if you ask another editor, they would clearly give you that answer. But, you know, after the first few cuts, we kind of finally settled on a final, so-called final cut, which was not much, but it was a little bit longer than this. And I sent it out to a few close friends and confidants and colleagues here in the industry. And then I got the same response. They're like, yeah, it's a little long. And to me, it didn't seem long for some reason. I thought it was too fast. I thought it was everything was too fast-paced. I thought it needed to be longer, but so I was clearly wrong. That was the first time I realized how wrongfully attached I am with this project. And my vision is, you know, and that's when I kind of realized that, you know, it would have been better to kind of find a way to raise some money to have an editor, like a professional editor, work on it. I'm just being completely honest with you. That's what happened. But I was like, it's too late to complain now, and it's too late to raise any money now. So I gave it another go. And finally, another happy accident. You know, I took out a few things for it, and I looked at it, and I showed it to my wife and my co-producer, and they're like, it works so much better, and it sort of worked out that way. A lot of happy accidents, I would say.
Was there a scene that you wished you didn't edit out of the film?
That's a tough question. No. I would have to, if you had asked me this a couple of weeks ago, I would have had an answer. But I think I'm satisfied with where it's at, with the length of the movie. And now that I'm learning about how audiences or whoever's watching it is taking it, and I think it's a good length. I think it was a good idea to remove those things.
Along with the VOD release, Chop Chop is available on DVD and Blu-ray. Are there any special features on the DVD and Blu-ray?
If there are, I'm not aware of them. Basically, what happened with me is I had this final cut and I delivered it to my distributors who were at Kamikaze Dogfight and Gravitas Ventures. And of course, they needed a few extra things in terms of stills, materials, and stuff like that. I'm personally not aware of. It just came out, DVD and Blu-ray. I haven't received a copy yet. I think it came out yesterday. I got a notification, but I haven't received a copy yet. I'm thinking I'll have it either by today, tomorrow, or Monday. Not that I'm aware of. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for that.
Any upcoming projects?
You know, I'm working with a few ideas, but nothing set in stone. It's a little uncertain over here in Los Angeles with how things are with COVID. I'm just sort of waiting it out. Want to see what happens. Definitely praying for things to open back up safely. So no, nothing set in stone.
Where can they find you and the film on social media?
I mean, you can find our website, chopchopmovie.com. Our Facebook page is like the go-to for all the social media updates. Facebook.com/chopchopmovie. And you can also find it, or you can follow us on Twitter for any updates at chopchopmovie. And myself, I'm on Facebook, Ronnie Patel, and I am also on Twitter at Ron, R-O-N, underscore E, underscore Patel.
Ronnie, I want to thank you for coming on to my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a good day and stay safe.
You too, sir.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
This is Carrie.
This is Billy.
This is Mr. Bo.
And we are from A Podcast from Beneath. You can catch us every Wednesday wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Don't forget, you can find Anthony T's Horror Show on social media, over on Facebook, Instagram, and Slasher app at Anthony T's Horror Show, on Twitter at Anthony T's Horror. If you liked this episode, you can subscribe to Anthony T's Horror Show over on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. You can also catch Anthony T's Horror Show over on DocDiscussions.com, where you can find my podcast and other podcasts on the Doc Discussions Network. What's Anthony T watching? Or I would like to turn this over into, was Anthony T lucky? Or was he not lucky? That is the question. As yours truly got to see the film that Shudder was hyping about, this secret film called Lucky. Yeah, that's right. Shudder played a gigantic trick on everyone. I'll give Shudder credit when they really do something out of the ordinary. That was definitely out of the ordinary. Because when I was thinking about the secret film that they announced that was going to play right after Halloween, I was automatically thinking this was going to be a Halloween-themed film. I was thinking Terrifier, candy corn, anything new. Quite frankly, I was really thinking Terrifier. Then, right after that film, we would get the big announcement that Terrifier 2 has been acquired by Shudder. Well, Terrifier 2 was not acquired by Shudder, nor did that film play. Which really surprised me, because I was thinking that was going to be the film that Shudder was talking about as this surprise film. Then afterwards get a surprise announcement. Well, it didn't happen. Well, my hopes are even gone up after I saw the Dread logo. Then the Epic Pictures logo. I was thinking, oh man, this is going to be Terrifier. Then afterwards they're going to announce Terrifier 2 is coming to Shudder in 2021. Like I said before, that did not happen. Instead, yours truly was going bananas, trying to figure out what film I was watching. Because this film, lucky that I'm going to talk about soon, had no title card. Meaning, yours truly had to go through IMDb trying to figure it out. Couldn't figure it out first time around. So I went to Shudder's Twitter page. Finally got a clue, then finally found out the film was Lucky. And to me, I'm very surprised they went with this film. Seriously. I was expecting something more fun, maybe along the lines of Halloween. Even I was expecting an outside chance that Shudder was going to be airing the 2018 version of Halloween. But instead, they aired Lucky. And I am guaranteeing you, some people were not amused. Me? Well, I liked this film a lot. I thought this was a really good film. Right up my alley to cap off what Shudder did. Playing a huge trick on us. Thinking it was going to be a big film or something big that people would be talking about horror-wise. But instead, they just played a film that is on the festival circuit. And will be hitting Shudder next year. But I did not expect it to be a film that really was going to make you think at 10:30 at night. Seriously. I was expecting a fun film, not a thought-provoking film at 10:30 at night. Like what I got with Lucky. Don't get me wrong. I love thought-provoking films. But at 10:30 at night, I was not expecting a thought-provoking film. As this one is going to probably divide some of the Shudder fan base. Because if you're the hardcore horror fan that loves Shudder and was looking for something fun, you are very disappointed. Me? I wasn't. Because one of the reasons why I really liked Lucky so much was the direction from Natasha Kermani, who is most known for a 2017 film Imitation Girl, which is also being carried on the Dread label. She does a very good job keeping the direction off balanced, as you don't know what is going on in this film for half of this film. As it's like a big mystery. I like the fact that she takes her time and makes sure that the performances are very good in this film. Because this is a film where you need the lead performance to be great. And this film has a great lead performance from Bree Grant, who I'll talk more about in a second, as she also wrote the screenplay for this film. Another thing that I really liked about Kermani's direction here was the way she directs some of these set pieces in this film. There are two in particular towards the end of the film which are very good. One involving the main character being questioned by many people at the same time, which was a well-executed scene by Kermani. And there's also a scene in a parking garage where this film really goes off the rails and becomes so mind-blowing. It's literally, I think, the best scene of the film. And this is a scene where you have to see this to believe it. It was so crazy. I would like to talk more about this scene, but this is a scene where I'm already giving too much away. Because it's a really focal point of the film. And if I start talking about it, I'll pretty much be giving the film away. So I'm not going to talk any more about the scene. It's just a scene you have to see. It's just so crazy. The way it was filmed and everything. That's what I think really helps makes Lucky, a really mind-blowing film. And the screenplay was great. One of the things I really liked about the screenplay, it starts off going in one direction, letting you take the bait, and you start to figure out, oh, such and such is such and such, which I won't go into because I don't want to spoil the film. Then it goes in a completely different direction in which you are just saying to yourself, what the hell? It's one of those films. You think it's going one direction, it goes the opposite direction. And it works very well here for Lucky, as it's one of the film's strong points, as it really made the story interesting. It left me asking more questions than it had answers. Maybe I have to see this film again to find out where did I go wrong. I like films that take risks and don't play it safe. Lucky is a film that does not play safe. It takes risks, and sometimes it doesn't pay off, sometimes it does. The screenplay here, it pays off, because you're into the film, you're asking questions, and you are really wondering how it's going to end. It is a really great film. It has mind-bending sequences, which I was not expecting in a film that was being billed as a secret film. I was expecting something big. Not a mind-blowing film that requires you to think, but this screenplay makes you think. And that's what really makes Lucky very good. It takes risks. It doesn't do the status quo. It has a story in which it takes you in a different direction, which made this screenplay very good. Because I was literally thought this was going to be a 90-minute predictable horror film. Instead, I got a 90-minute film in which it goes off and it really is something to talk about. Because seriously, I was not planning on talking about this film on this edition of the podcast. I was literally planning on talking maybe on another film that recently came out in 2020. But the fact that Lucky is a film that really questions what is going on in this film is an achievement in itself. Because personally, if you see a film and you're going this one direction and you think, oh, this is going to happen and that's it, then you're not going to like the film. Or you're going to like the film, but I don't know if I want to spend time talking about this film. Because seriously, this is a film that's gotten me to talk about, because I was not planning on talking about this film on this episode. In fact, I wasn't planning on talking about the secret film from Shudder on this episode. But the way this film was constructed and the way that this film was directed is done in a very good way, that it really is thought-provoking and really makes me want to watch it again to see where I went wrong. Because I was thinking this film was going in one direction, then it goes the complete opposite. I need to see this film again. I really do. Too bad I gotta wait to 2021. Definitely check out Lucky when it hits Shudder in 2021. In fact, I'm probably buying the Blu-ray once this comes out on Blu-ray. But for you people who have Shudder, definitely check this film out if you're into thought-provoking horror films. If you're into slasher Halloween type films like what they were playing on Halloween night, then I don't think you would like this film. But I can see why people don't like this film. But for me, this film has great performances, a very original screenplay, and great direction from Natasha Kermani. That's what makes Lucky a very good film. And definitely a film people should check out when it hits Shudder in 2021. On DocDiscussions.com, you can find my latest column reviews from a horror show up there, as I talk about not one, but two films. I talk about the thriller Becky, starring Kevin James and Lulu Wilson. And I talk about Killer Therapy, which features some classic 80s horror actors, including Thorne Matthews from Return of the Living Dead, Adriana King from Friday the 13th, and PJ Solis from Halloween, the original one. You can check that column up on DocDiscussions.com right now. Coming up next episode on episode 54, I will be talking to the founder and president of Fright Rags, Benjamin Shivens. Definitely check out that interview next episode. And I'm also possibly working on one more guest. Stay tuned. With that, I want to thank you for listening to the latest episode of Anthony T's Horror Show. Don't forget, if you like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. And don't forget the social media pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and the Slasher app. I want to thank you for listening. Have a good day. Stay safe and support indie horror.